This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
I'm excited to announce our podcast show is part of this year's Dell Technologies Small Business Virtual Conference that kicked off May 10th. Small businesses are ready to thrive again and looking for resources to rise to the challenge. That's why Dell Technologies has assembled an all-star lineup of podcasters for the third year in a row to create a virtual conference to share advice and inspiration for small businesses. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. Search Dell Technologies Small Business Podference on Audacy.com, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts starting May 10th. And if you missed it, be sure to download our custom episodes that aired May 12th and May 20th.
Live from the Fayetteville Public Library, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Today, we're live from the great state of Arkansas, which isn't just the home of Tyson Chicken and a little company called Walmart, but, of course, a fintech firm called AcreTrader. On today's special Dell Podference episode, we're diving deep into how a company is built with founder Carter Malloy. We'll ask him where the dream began, missteps along the path, how the company grew to be the successful investing platform it is today, and Carter's thoughts on the future of investing. No trivia, no headlines, just Joe and Carter and the epic tale of a little, check that, quickly growing company that could. And now, the guy who didn't go to the University of Arkansas, but his money did, honorary Razorback, Joe Saul-Sehy.
Hello there, Fayetteville. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. I am Joe Saul-Sehy, Average Joe Money on Twitter. This is so weird being live in front of a bunch of Razorbacks. We got a bunch of Razorbacks here. You know, and he was right. My money did go here. My daughter graduated from the fine university that's right up the street. And when he said my money went here, it's this university is not just a fantastic place to get an education, but even though it's incredibly affordable, I got to say, I did feel like every time I wrote one of those checks, I felt like, am I buying a wing of a building or am I just trying to put my daughter through school? Anybody putting kids through school or put yourself through school feel the same way? Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're not here to talk about that today. We're here to talk about a career trajectory. You know, it's funny. There's lots of people in our audience that are either thinking about starting a business, they have a business, and you think you're alone when it comes to business. And yet, every time we talk to entrepreneurs, we find out that most entrepreneurs have many of the same feelings. They have many of the same struggles that they're dealing with. In a second, we're going to dive into those with one founder. But first, this segment is sponsored by Dell Technologies Small Business Virtual Podference, which starts May 10th. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. All right, Fayetteville, you ready for us to bring on our guest? Ladies and gentlemen, this is the man behind a company that is very quickly growing. They're a company that I feel very lucky that I've known about this company since very close to the beginning. When I was first approached by somebody that knew about this company, I thought, why aren't there other companies doing this? Why aren't more companies investing in farmland? This gentleman is somebody that thought the same thoughts I was having. So let's meet him right now. Ladies and gentlemen, the founder of Acre Trader, Carter Malloy. How are you, man?
Wonderful.
You and I have talked, what, maybe three times before? But this is the first time we're face-to-face. You're a good-looking dude.
My wife's out there somewhere. Make sure she hears that.
You ready to talk about your career trajectory?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about the start, because a lot of people think that entrepreneurship is in somebody's genes. And really, for you, I think that's actually a little bit true, because your mom was an entrepreneur?
That's correct. My mom ran a business growing up.
What type of a business was it?
It was a candy business, which is both the best and worst business possible for a kid to be around all day long.
Candy. What type of candy?
All of the kinds.
So was she like a distributor? Did she?
That's right. She had a candy business that had done well, and then she began franchising that and teaching other people how to build businesses.
How big did that business get?
There were hundreds of them.
Hundreds of them. Okay. And I would imagine that's an up and down business. I can't imagine the business of candy is easy all the time.
The business of candy is actually great. This was sort of like later in life, call it high school. Leading up to that, there were both my mom and dad were entrepreneurs, and there are lots of swing years, we'll call them.
Well, I want to ask about then your dad, because if your mom is an entrepreneur and things are sometimes up and down, I bet your dad had something really steady that he did.
Yeah, farming, super steady.
I had a client when I was a financial planner that ran a farm and said, what did the farmer do when they won the $1 million lottery? They farmed it till it was gone. Which, by the way, they were doing very well, and a lot of farmers do incredibly well. And we'll talk about how you guys work with farmers to help them do well. But farming also has some up and downs.
It does. It creates some challenging years. And my dad also had a lot of wild ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. And so, yeah, we had some fun times and some, oh gosh, moments along the way.
What do you mean by that? Dad had some entrepreneurial ideas.
He's kind of an interesting guy. So he had an undergrad in mathematics, then did his master's degree in geology, was big into, while he was always in farming and groundwater, was really big into drilling for oil, as an example. One of those wild ideas, and that went really well.
Drilling for oil on the farm?
Actually, up here in Northwest Arkansas. He was the first, he and a few partners, the first people to find shale gas up here. And it was a big, big deal in a very positive way. And then dry. And yeah. Then, you know, everything was gone.
So I can't imagine your mom and dad ever fought about money or had any conflicts at all.
They got along pretty well, actually.
That's good. Yeah. Two entrepreneurs. Now you, though, I understand, were like the perfect model kid growing up.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I see my children out there and they're 4 and 6 years old. So I might withhold some of those stories until they're a little bit older.
Well, I have it on the sheet that you wrote me as we were prepping for this, that you were a wild child. Sorry. Can you explain what wild child looked like, young Carter?
Anna Kate, Vivian, close your ears.
Earmuffs.
I didn't have tons of motivation in the right directions at points.
What do you think that was?
I found school to be not fun. You know, it was boring, and so I cut up in class a lot, and got in a lot of trouble.
But this is interesting because on one hand, you find school not fun, and yet you skipped a grade at one point.
I did. I moved up a grade. My older sister is wildly intelligent, maybe the only way I could describe her. And so pretty early on, my parents and the school realized that this kid's special. And she actually ended up graduating high school and going to college when she was 12.
In college when she's 12?
Yeah, it was actually a terrible idea. Don't send your kids to college that young.
That's what I was thinking, because Carter, even when I was prepping for this and I found out that you had skipped a grade, you know, everybody talks about emotionally how difficult that can be for a kid. All of a sudden you're with kids that are further along physically than you are. Some of the, you know, the development stuff going on is different. I imagine that's hard, but college at 12?
Yeah, that was hard on her. And so they, ultimately, I as well, they're like, oh, maybe this kid's smart too. And they had me take a bunch of tests and come to find out that was not my sister.
it was, you were the diamond in a rough that was mostly rough.
Yeah. So, ended up moving up a grade, and I was already young for my school anyway. I was a summer birthday. So that actually did create a lot of challenges as a kid. That I think the bigger success for me was being able to navigate that, being a 16-year-old coming to college of trying to be normal. And, you know, 16, I was like, I was 14 years old. And so I met my wife the first night of college and was like, hey, let's go on a date. She's like, you are a child. So it took a while. But
Wait a minute. You met her the first day of college.
I did.
We're skipping way ahead, but tell me this story.
Met her the first night of college. That was the most beautiful person I'd ever seen. And coming to find out, she's really cool too. And so,
but did you like sit next to her in a class? Like, did you walk up to her on the, no, you know, were you at the student union? Just walk up to her, this creepy kid that's younger than everybody else there.
I might have mentioned earlier, I did not do great in school. It was at a party. It was that first night of college, big party, you know, just like the second night of college and the third night. And so we met and I was just smitten with her. And yeah, she's like, you're a great friend, but you're a child. And so we were best friends all through college and then began dating at the end of college.
And you just stuck around and stuck around.
Persistence. I'm the rare escape the friend zone guy.
That's the lesson.
Yeah, but yes. Persistence did pay off.
Persistence pays. I want to get back though to skipping the grade for just a second longer, because I know there's, you know, there's parents thinking about this all the time. I've got this smart kid. I think it might be a good idea. Do you think that was the right decision? If you had that to do over again, would you have done that? Or would you have just continued on the way that most people do?
Probably not. I was hungry for it because I didn't love school. Yeah. So I thought, oh, this is like a cheat code to move along a little faster. But it's certainly for my sister as well. Like that's a pretty extreme example. But no, I don't think it's a brilliant idea unless the circumstances are correct.
With entrepreneur parents, I got to imagine that Carter Malloy growing up might have had an entrepreneurship venture or two during high school years, maybe even during college years. Were you starting companies even back then?
Yeah, we'll skip over those. I mentioned again earlier that I was not a great student, but I did after college. I was touring in a band, and to support that band, we converted our van to run on grease, like unused vegetable oil, and saved a ton of money. And so the bass player and I are like, oh, this is a cool idea. We'll stand up a business. And that actually succeeded. It was a good business and paid the bills enough for us to travel around and play music. Then I was like, ooh, I'm a great business person. I'll start some more businesses. And the next two were dumpster fires is the best way I could describe them.
Yeah, I actually did some homework on those. And I wanted to ask you specifically about the dumpster fires. In one of your bios, I saw you had a business focused on internet marketing.
Yes. So it was a business it was a early social network. This is like 2005, 2006 maybe. I'd grown up around this franchising idea, and so the idea was to connect franchisees and franchisors on this platform, and that was a big failure in testing product market fit before actually launching something. Like, oh, this is so brilliant, this is going to be a huge business, and built this thing and spent savings on it and then put it out there and never made a dollar of revenue.
How much money did you spend developing that business?
Thousands, maybe $10,000, which like a, you know, for a person in their early 20s, was like most of it.
Yeah, and then the sustainable fuel tech is what you were already referring to, and that's from being in a band.
That's right. That was the genesis of that.
But I got to guess, though, you know, for somebody that runs a business like you do, where there's been so many times at Acre Trader where you've had to be at the seat of your pants, right? You're not sure what's going to happen the next week, the next month, especially in the early days. I have to imagine that these early failures were really great lessons.
Yes, they were. They're also a little bit scarring, right? Like, oh gosh, this may not work. And so it certainly drives a little bit of negative mentality as well. But the positive lesson from that is like, it is absolutely okay to fail. And it is absolutely okay to make mistakes. And that was the big carryover into investing career for me for a long time. And today in our business as well, we celebrate mistakes and we cheer people that stand up and admit when they have those failures.
Going back to college for just a moment, you said you weren't great at school, but you were a physics major. So if you're thinking about a band, meeting your wife at a party, physics, I don't know a lot, Carter, but I do know that that's not the world's easiest major. Like, how do you choose physics?
I liked it. I went to the business school and I got like a C in accounting. I was like, this crap is boring. And I'd taken some physics courses. I was pre-med before that. And I just liked the subject matter. And so for me, it was, and again, was not a straight A student.
Yeah.
But it was really fun to explore just problem solving is ultimately what physics is. And it sounds daunting, but it's actually like pretty straightforward. It's numbers.
You talk about problem solving. Do you use that today? I mean, I would have to imagine that that kind of helps your thought process today, working through A, B, C, D.
That's totally fair. I mean, the last time I solved an equation was 18 years ago, you know, in school. But that sort of methodical approach to problem solving is helpful. And again, I constantly still fail at that, right? It's a lifelong learning experience, but that was certainly helpful.
What would you tell people about school in the role of an entrepreneur then, seeing that you've said several times here already that school was not your forte? School for the entrepreneur, what are your thoughts?
School is a place to learn, to socialize, and to for me to have fun. Like I said, it was a bad student, but I had a lot of fun in school. I studied a lot outside of class. I read a ton and was practicing music every day for most of the days. So I still tried to be very productive with my time. At that point, the endeavor for me was pursuing music as opposed to being entrepreneurial at that time. Though looking back, I'm sure I would have enjoyed doing that also.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what instrument you played.
At the time, I was playing lead guitar and a little bit of keyboards. But drums is my primary pursuit today.
So you still play?
I do. I like to play and produce music as well. So
we have an Acre Trader band?
We should. There's actually a lot of people in our
We should. We could have had like an opening act here, Carter. What are we doing? Michael, we didn't think that through, man. Let's talk briefly about you and technology growing up, because as you know, this is part of the Dell Podference collection of podcasts. Technology clearly is in your life all the time. It's a big part of what you do at Acre Trader. Tell me about Carter as a kid growing up. Were you somebody that was in tech, interested in tech? Did you use technology much growing up?
I did a lot. I really enjoyed it a lot. At the time, this is like late 90s in high school, they had these TI-83 calculators.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a powerhouse calculator at the time. This thing was a beauty. And
you can tell we're finance nerds, by the way. We're like, oh, yeah, that's the calculator. Ooh. Can you describe the calculator slowly, please?
Well, I got into making games on them, again, as a distraction from class, and so got into programming a little bit and understanding how to build things on a computer and then transfer them onto this little tiny calculator so that I could play games in class, basically.
But when did you make your first website?
I made one in college, but I'm trying to remember the year. Probably 2001.
What was it about?
Jokes.
It was about jokes?
Yeah, yeah. We won't talk about that one. Like,
dad jokes?
I've been scrubbing a lot of the internet for a lot of years, too.
All right, we'll bury that part. Maybe we'll clean that one out in post, right, of this conversation. I want to ask about then mentors growing up. Before we get to Acre Trader, there must have been some people in your life that really kind of molded the leader that you are today. Tell me about some of those people, either in school or maybe with the band, people with the companies that you worked for before Acre Trader.
My dad certainly is a big one. We still speak most days. He's pretty risk on, right? Lived in Costa Rica for 6 years growing bananas, has been in multiple plane crashes. And so I think that sort of taught me like, get out and have fun and enjoy life. I think he...
Wait a minute, your dad's been in plane crashes and you're like, let's go fly more?
Yeah, well, you get a couple, like, you know, what's going to happen next time? I'll probably live again. Like, he, at one point to me, said, God bless me with being curious, therefore I've had a really full life. Always pushed us as kids to get out, go travel, go have fun and learn and enjoy life and not turn on the TV.
Who else?
Partner in the fund that I used to work at. So one of my partners in the investment fund, a guy named Clinton, who could not be more different human beings, like in every possible regard. But he remains one of my absolute best friends, and he's just a brilliant guy, but he's incredibly well-tempered. And I'm not. I tend to be a little more volatile. And you know, he was never shaken by investments when we were investing professionally and things would whip around and he just wouldn't care. And if he was convicted, he would stick to that. and ultimately really helped me improve. I still need a lot more improvement to ultimately stick to your guns and be confident when you make a decision and lean in.
I want to talk about those jobs. We talked about the entrepreneurship part, but really out of college, you went to work in the investment world. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, I spent 7 years writing research on companies that built data analytics, that built property technology, and fintech. So a lot of the things that overlap with my job today. Then after that, I spent 5 years at a long short equity fund out in San Francisco. So we were investing about $1 billion in all kinds of companies, but I was primarily focused again on technology and a little bit of consumer and industrial.
Why did you move from that first company to the second one?
Risk on. You know, I joined it before they had raised a dollar of assets. And it's like, hey, it's my opportunity to go be a partner in something really, really cool and really unique that I wanted to explore. And I absolutely love the people putting it together. And that moment, I was sort of panicking, leaving this great job as a managing director at this cool company. And one of my coworkers told me, it's like, make every important decision as your 80-year-old self. When you look back when you're 80, will you regret doing this? And at that moment, and I remember where I was standing and having this conversation, it's like, well, this is a no-brainer then. Like, worst case, I go out here and we fall flat on our face, we fail. Like, I can probably still get another job and I'll have a great time and learn a bunch along the way.
I love this idea of having a North Star. And I love the lesson, I think, from when you talk about the partner at the fund being a mentor of yours. I think too often we surround ourselves with people that are like us instead of people that challenge us.
100%. It's something we focus on within our business quite a bit. Used to, in hiring, we would have these tests, like the airport test. You hear about this a lot in an interview, where the people of the company say, well, would you prefer to be stuck at an airport for 24 hours with this person locked down? The problem with that is you then end up surrounding yourselves with people that are just like you, and people that think like you, and people you agree with. And that's actually a really bad way to build a business. Instead of challenging yourself to sit down and go, you know what, this person is like, are we going to go like be absolute bros on the weekends and have beers? Like, probably not. But like, wow, this person is fascinating and completely different than me and has really cool ideas. And so we talk about company culture within our business, this notion of hiring people that are additive to your culture, right? So not just fit, but they're different in a certain way, diversity of thought, if you will. And really, yes, we really, really champion that idea of being different.
I want to get back to technology with that answer, but I got to imagine when you're scaling a company, you must have some technology using that helps you identify people that are different areas. Like, how do you figure out how to put these right people in the right spot?
We do. So we have some great folks running HR for us, and they've got really cool software that certainly helps us, applicant tracking software, so that's called ATS, that helps us to score individually so that we don't. Like, the worst thing we could do as a company is if each person, you interview somebody, they come through an interview roughly with a dozen folks internally at our business. The worst thing you could do is have those people get together and whip around with biases. And so instead we use this software to keep us independent and neutral. So we each leave ratings and, you know, hey, this person scored great on creativity, they great on humility, self-awareness. The things that we really value as a business. So that certainly helps.
It's funny, even in our small business, we started, there's only 8 of us versus a lot more Acre Trader. But for our last round of hiring, we used technology to help us, and it was amazing. It was incredible how much better the people were that came through because of the fact that, like you, I'm naturally biased. I'm naturally like, I like you. Let's go hang out, you know. I want to ask you a couple more questions before we take our break. Let's talk about Acre Trader and the making of the very beginning day. I'm really curious. You're working at the fund in San Francisco, I'm imagining. How does the idea for Acre Trader begin? Where's the seed, to use an Acre Trader term? How does the seed of this, that cracked me up, not them, crack nobody. There's going to be a lot more of those peeps, so hang on. Where did the seed of this idea come from?
Farm puns are impossible to avoid. They're everywhere. In the background, my dad and I have been buying and selling farmland, and it's this fascinating market, right? There's trillions of dollars of this stuff.
When did you start doing this?
Mid-2000s, so probably around the recession, something like that.
Okay, so you've been out of college maybe 4 or 5 years.
That's correct.
Okay.
So I had a great career, and started messing around and just, I'd always been in love with land. It was just a thing, this sense of place, of being outdoors and having a place to be. And so I'd been buying and selling land for years.
Can I stop you for a second? Because I'm very interested in this. Your first deal, you got to remember your first deal. Who came to the table with your first deal? Was it you or your dad?
My dad. He and a buddy said, hey, we're putting this thing together. It's totally screwed up and real ugly, and there's all this hair on it, but it's pretty fascinating from a financial standpoint.
Fantastic. It's a horrible deal. Let's do it.
Yeah, well, it was what we call in value investing, dumpster diving.
Okay.
Right, which is investing in businesses that are really messed up.
Yes.
But have lots of potential.
We can turn them around.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right.
Tons of upside.
That's
how,
right.
How did that work?
Incredibly well. Like, oh my gosh, what's going on? I'm over here spending 12, 14 hours every day and most weekends grinding, trying to find alpha in public market investing with this concentrated investing style. And over here on the side, like for fun, as an interesting investment, generating like very material investment returns. And that's ultimately what got me looking at this asset class and zooming out and realizing like, wow, it's not just like cool. It's not just land that I love, but there's actually a real financial story here around portfolio diversification and the potential to hedge against inflation and long-term risk-adjusted returns and non-correlation of the stock market. Like the story just kept going on and on about this.
But it's also something in your backyard that you've got a long, familiar relationship with.
And that's really how it started, right? So I'm living in San Francisco. I'm clearly like a little more redneck than most of the folks around me. And so I had this distinct investing advantage that I did not usually have being from Arkansas, in that I knew these places, right? And had friends in San Francisco that wanted to invest in land as well. But online, it's like, well, there's nothing here. How could that possibly be? Like, and I'm realizing I'm buying land, like getting flyers in the mail quite literally, which we still do today. One of the primary ways that land is bought and sold.
So you're getting flyers from farmers?
From farmers and farm brokers. We're talking about like multi-million dollar parcels. Like that's the marketing behind them.
Via a flyer. A multi-million dollar deal via flyer.
It is difficult to explain how prevalent this is.
That's an idea where somebody might need some technology right there.
If only there was like this company that would...
If there were.
You know, there's this notion of information asymmetry in investing markets, right? And that is that you have a distinct advantage relative to the market because you can see something they don't. In public companies, you work really, really hard to build a little bit of an edge, to build a mosaic picture of a business. But if you get a distinct edge, often that's called inside information and you go to jail for it.
Yeah.
Right? So right. That's not a good thing.
Thanks for defining that, by the way. Jail bad.
In private assets, that's not the case. And in farmland, you don't even have to really work that hard to find the information advantage. It's just that there is no information. So therefore, the old adage of in the land of the blind, the man with one eye is king, rang really true here, that you can go out and dig in and understand this asset at a fundamental level and do real financial due diligence in relatively short amounts of time to the whatever month or so we'd spend in public company investing. So I became pretty obsessed with investing in farmland on the side. I'm coming around. This is a long-winded story.
No, it's all right. I keep stopping you because I'm interested about the pieces of it. So you and your dad been buying on the side and...
So my dad calls me in 2017. He's like, hey, I think I'm going to buy some Bitcoin. All right. Now, mind you, at this time, he's early 80s. He does read technology blogs every day. But I'm like, you idiot. Why would you buy this stupid asset that's backed by air? There's nothing there. And it's like $1,000.
In 2017, yeah.
Yeah, whoops. Like side note, guys, don't take investment advice from me. and so he's like, you know, yeah, you're right. He unfortunately did not invest in Bitcoin on my advice. He's, okay, yeah, you're right. But man, I wish we could create some token backed by farmland, to which I then again said, yeah, tokens are a fad. I think that's really dumb, Dad. You know, that's never going to work. Again, whoops.
What does fungible even mean? Come on.
But it started really kicking around this idea of fractionalization and securitization. And in public markets, the IPO process of taking a big asset and breaking it into small pieces so that regular investors can access it, that was the norm. In private markets, it was incredibly difficult due to regulation. The Jobs Act had been passed in 2012. It had been formalized the ensuing years. So there was finally this opportunity to take these million-dollar assets rather than billion-dollar assets, million-dollar assets, and break them up and make them more approachable.
How did you know about that?
Lawyers. So, you know, my dad and I had talked about it. I'd seen a few websites offering these fractional investments. I said, well, how on earth are they doing that? And so luckily I have a great friend here in Fayetteville, Jason Bramlett. So Colin said, hey, can you help me figure this out? So we started digging in.
And then last, before we go to the break, the name AcreTrader then. So now you have this idea. You know that you can fractionalize these farmland properties. How do you get the name?
So I do like process. And so I went through this really formal process and built out this spreadsheet. I tried to get to 100 names. I did not get there. And I got to, oh my God, every one of these names is a terrible idea. I showed it to two people that I work with, and I will never show it to anyone else again because they make fun of me all the time and about how poor my creativity with names is. So I bought a couple of names for like $15 online, and there was this one AcreTrader that I was just really obsessed with, but it was $1,200. And this was really eating at me. Like, again, this idea of like, I'm going to pay you for nothing. You just bought this thing for $15 and you're going to sell it to me for $1,500 or $1,200.
That's crazy.
And so I took great offense to it. I slept on it a bunch. Luckily, we've worked with one of the advisors to our business today. And I told him the story and showed him the other domain names. And again, it's like, you idiot, just pony up and buy the name. So thank goodness I did that. I did try to make it back in other places. So our logo, the logo that we use today was designed for either $15 or $18 on Fiverr.
Really?
So I got on some outsourcing.
The awesome website. AcreTrader logo is a Fiverr logo.
That is correct.
Fiverr's been a sponsor of this podcast.
Hey.
So yes, there it is. An endorsement from Carter. Fantastic. Coming up later, second half of this interview, we're going to dive into the early days of AcreTrader. How did things run at the beginning? Getting that first investor, building confidence, and then scaling the company. That's all coming up when we come right back.
I'm excited to announce our podcast show is part of this year's Dell Technologies Small Business Virtual Conference that kicked off May 10th. Small businesses are ready to thrive again and looking for resources to rise to the challenge. That's why Dell Technologies has assembled an all-star lineup of podcasters for the third year in a row to create a virtual conference to share advice and inspiration for small businesses. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. Search Dell Technologies Small Business Podference on Audacy.com, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts starting May 10th. And if you missed it, be sure to download our custom episodes that aired May 12th and May 20th.
Welcome back. So in the first half of this live interview in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Carter shared with us how he was an excellent student. He was a stalker of a particular woman. And what else did we learn about he goes cheap on his logo? No, it's probably none of what we learned. I think we learned very much about the power of having good people around you, of riffing, of creativity. And now let's talk about AcreTrader in the very beginning, Carter, because now you have this idea, you have this company, you're ready to launch it. Did you do what a lot of people did? You've been in San Francisco, you're very close to Silicon Valley then. This is going to be a fintech company. Did you go out and find a bunch of people to back the company? Did you find investors?
Initially, no. I was lucky enough to be able to fund the initial MVP, minimum viable product, right? So the early tech I built at night and hired a team to help build that.
You had learned about minimum viable product how?
The internet. Hey, I have this idea. I want to build a technology. And just then calling around to tech CEOs and folks I knew in that world and asking, like, what next?
Yeah. So what did the minimum viable product look like?
It was hideous, of course. It was a functional website that told people what we did. And allowed you to come on and click through and start an investment. You could not actually finish the investment, but what we were looking for was signals that people were actually going to come in and use it to invest.
So somebody would come in, they give you some information, then you would maybe call the person or send them something afterwards?
That's right. So actually pre-minimum viable product, ran a bunch of surveys and went out and ran surveys to see, like, do people actually care if we build this? Then we built it. And people did care. They're like, we got tons of really, really positive feedback. So at that moment it was, all right, do the wild thing and quit work and move to Arkansas to start a tech company.
So once you had the minimum viable product, how many investors did you have when you decided to quit your job?
Zero.
None. Were you married yet?
Yes, with two children, one baby.
And what did your spouse say when you said, hey, I'm quitting my job and I've got this company that has no money coming in, let's move?
Lucky for me, she's a lot cooler than I am. So she was completely unshaken. She thought it was a great idea.
Fantastic. When you found all this interest in AcreTrader, a lot of people very interested in buying farmland. That's still not an investor, though. Tell me how long it took to get the first investor, and you got to remember that moment.
A really, really long time.
It did.
And it was frightening, right? So, people love this thing, and they did, right? People were like, wow, I get to invest in the heartland and bring money into rural communities and support farmers. This is a great idea. I want to play a part in this. And you guys seem like you actually have this figured out and some great a great investment offering. We had one farm on the website.
Yeah.
And so people absolutely loved it and were like, great. It's so nice to meet you. You know, the investment minimum is at this time like $1,000.
You're asking for $1,000.
Yeah. And they'd be like, oh yeah, I'll put in $10,000. This is great. And then 2 days go by and then you go into your CRM, you call them up. Hey, you're still interested in investing. And they would say, remind me again, how old's your company? Like, 6 months. And where are you guys located? Arkansas? You can imagine, even today, as a well-funded business, this notion of, we just met on the internet, and I'm going to give you a whole bunch of money to some yokels in Arkansas was a pretty difficult value proposition for those extremely early adopters. No one wanted to be the first across the line.
How many people were working for the company at this time?
Eight, nine, a number. Like I had, at this point, built the MVP, showed the interest, then hired a few folks, then went out and started raising some capital. So we
got it. Okay, so you did get some capital by this time.
That's correct. So at six people on the team went out and was like, all right, we have a product now. We've got good product market fit, at least according to what we're being told by these customers and all this feedback we have. So went out and raised some money.
How hard is that, getting funding?
Brutal. It's absolutely awful. You walk in like, I have the best idea in the whole world, and all of you are going to be super rich for investing in this company. And just about everyone says no. And unfortunately, then a lot of people won't tell you no. And that's the worst thing they can do, right, is just drag you along.
Because they're just wasting your time.
Yeah, and worse, like teasing you, right?
Yeah.
Versus we find it, and still today, we always ask anybody that's interested in the business or investing in farmland, hey, if you end up not being interested in this, we would love to know why. We want to improve as a business and improve our product. And so please help us.
There's competing thoughts about where you go to first for funding for your new company. If you go to friends and family first, do you go to venture capitalists first? Do you look online at angels? Where did you go first?
All of them.
All.
Yeah, I think, build a spreadsheet and put every name I knew in there, that anybody that had any capital themselves, and then asked my friends that were venture capital to make introductions. And so, yeah, chased every intro and then asked each one of those people, who else should I be speaking to?
Who were some of the early adopters? Maybe not by name, but were they friends and family or were they venture capitalists?
They were more friends. So folks that ran larger tech companies.
Do you find that it's a little like Shark Tank where they're asking for a bigger piece of the company all the time?
No. No, I was really surprised at, even today, at just how friendly term sheets are, how friendly the investors in our business are, and how like all of them are well-intentioned. They want the company to succeed. And I think there's a surprising, I was surprised by this myself, but the prevailing school of thought is like, make the pie bigger.
Yeah.
Don't get in here and elbow with sharp elbow. And sharp elbows to take a bigger slice or to get these aggressive terms. It does help that the funding environment for technology startups is one of the best of our lifetimes.
Did you go to any of the, what's the big show where people go and pitch in fintech every year?
I don't know.
It's right on the top of my head.
Like TechCrunch or something?
They have two of them. They have one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and people go up and make like a 5-minute pitch. Techstars? Yeah, that's not the one that I'm thinking of. But did you do any of those? Did you do any of these pitch competitions?
I did a couple and found them to be pretty awful.
Yeah. So now you have six people working for the company. Your company has a burn rate, obviously. I'm betting you know every day exactly what that number is. It's got to be a number that just you've seared into your brain. Tell me about when somebody finally gave you money. When somebody finally, not invested in the company, but they invested in farmland.
I remember the day well. This was in the spring of 2019. And we had been out, you know, some people 5-6 calls in, learning about the business and about us and building trust with them. And that was really this big barrier was trust. And no one wanted to be the first. And then this guy who we had spoken to once, who was super nice. And again, the investment minimum was $1,000. And he came in and put in $50,000.
Yeah.
And to say that we were screaming and jumping up and down, like, oh my God, it's actually a company now. It was a big day.
That's fantastic. So you guys are going crazy because you have a $50,000. Per person gave you 50 times what you'd originally asked for.
That's correct.
Did that open up a floodgate like you were hoping? Now that you've got the first one?
No. It began to move the flywheel. Right, so we're a two-sided marketplace business. There's real network effects between finding farms and finding investment capital, or finding farmers that are growing and finding investment capital to support them by buying land. And that was the first sort of like notch, right? Like you're making a snowball and you scoot it along and then it just stops. And so then there's this Herculean effort to move it just another inch, then it stops. And there was no inertia within the business. So the following 6 months was still an absolute knife fight every day when we came to work of just trying to get this flywheel moving.
Yeah, and I'm doing the math just in my head. You know, I don't know an asset manager that says, obviously you guys are really excited about a $50,000 investment, but there's no asset manager out there that says you can run a company on a $50,000 investment. Tell me how long it did finally take it to start rolling.
We had green shoots along the way, right? So it's not as if every day was bad. I was working with amazing people. They were brilliant. We were all working every hour of every day to continue to build the technology, the content, and ultimately to build trust, right? If the barrier to our business, we're dealing with incredibly important things to people, their money and their land. And so trust was the big thing to get over. So how can we attack this every day is education. So just being wide open about who we are, what we're up to, what we're building. And
so you really became more of a teacher. Your pitch was teaching people.
No question. We had to evangelize the asset class for many of the customers that were coming in. And so providing tons and tons of written content and white papers and unbiased information, right? Maintaining a neutral professional tone while doing so.
At the same time, I got to imagine once again, to be able to scale that teaching, there's only so many of you. How did you use technology to make that teaching happen more quickly? How to scale your ability to talk to more people more quickly?
CRM is the easy answer there. So we used HubSpot and it's unbelievable, right? So whether it's HubSpot or Asana, the tools available to a company of our size today versus just 10 years ago are absolutely night and day. And so we were able to stand up a very scalable business model very fast because of technology enablement.
Did you ever think about search engine optimization and getting incoming traffic coming in?
We did a ton. We spent a lot of those early days thinking about SEO.
Is that effective though? Because, you know, when you and I first talk, you're like, nobody's thinking about this asset class. So there can't be a ton of people on Google or Bing who are typing in, how do I get rich on farmland?
That's right. So we went to lots of third parties as well and said, hey, we'll write for your blog. We'll put content on your website about what we're up to and help drive traffic to you. And for us, it gave a link back, which also helps your search engine optimization.
You guys came on Stacking Benjamins and educated our audience.
That's right.
In the early days. That was fun.
So our one of our first podcasts, if not the first one.
Was it really?
Yeah.
that was super fun. You came across like this is, well, exactly like you do now. Just confident, put together, know the asset class, very comfortable. Under the hood, though, at that time, a little bit shakier than Joe thought it was.
No, I think we were comfortable. And again, it was hard, but we were very comfortable that this was a thing, that this is a business that we were going to will the damn thing to succeed, but ultimately it was going to succeed because there was so much interest out there and because we had built a rare business model. It was a win-win. It was a win for farmers to grow their business by us buying land alongside them. And it was a win for the investors to get access to this new asset class.
Tell me about though, there must have been some days when you come home to your family And you're thinking, we just got to let this go.
Yeah, there were. You know, I think there were a lot of those days. You know, we got to let this go, maybe a little harsh, but oh no, you know, I've done something wrong, or oh no, I broke the website again. Those were painful days. But yeah, like as with any venture, like I still have tons of terrible days today. It's just, it's like having a child, right? Where the old saying is, the days are long, but the weeks are short, right? And in business and building a business, it's the same thing. Like we have really challenging days, but we step back and look up and go, over the last 1 week or the last 1 month, oh my God, look at the tremendous progress we've made.
That's funny. I had a mentor tell me recently that you need to live in the gain, not in the gap. And what they meant by that was we're always looking at the horizon and thinking, man, I want to reach that. But if you play that game, you're always going to lose. Instead, what you're saying is what my mentor said, look back and go, look at the progress we made. We're moving.
And then put your head down and grind.
Yeah. It. Yeah. For people that are in that spot right now, what would you tell them about those dark days and maybe some advice about how you got through them?
What we're just talking about is stepping back and being proud of what you've done and acknowledging, you know, certainly acknowledging the problems, right? And ultimately, you've got to compartmentalize. So, all right, there are these risks and there are these issues and there are these concerns. What can I do to address them? Because worrying does nothing. But instead, all right, well, I've got this risk and I'm going to go prioritize these three things that I can fight back against that with. And always having those top two or three priorities every day when you come into work to make sure you go do everything you can to fight against that risk.
Action over worry.
There you go.
Any stories of meetings that were pivotal, big investor meetings, big pitches that you can think of, big milestones along the way, Carter, where you went, wow, we just, there's, do you remember the movie Wall Street? And Bud Fox walks out of this meeting with Gordon Gekko, or he's walking into the meeting, he's looking himself in the mirror, and he says, there's a few big moments in life. This is one of them. What are a couple of those big moments in Carter's Acre Trader life?
I'm not sure any of them are as glorious or dirty as that movie. On the specific to the investor question, RZC is a fund owned by a few members of the Walton family here locally, and we had been speaking with them for a long time. We had a few other investors fall through, actually, that were going to invest in our seed round. And I can remember the specific church I was near in the middle of nowhere, Arkansas, when I got the phone call. I was like, honey, hit the brakes and pull over. I hopped out of the car and took this call, and they confirmed that they were going to invest.
And they're investing.
That was a big day. Perhaps the most memorable moment is for investors was actually, though, investors in farms. This was just post-COVID lockdown, and I had a tent in the front yard. I was going to camp with my girls outside. We just got a new tent, wanted to test it out. So tents in the front yard, we put this new farm up, and it was a little over $1 million. And to that point, we had done maybe one or two six-figure days.
Okay.
And this is kind of like April, post-COVID, April 2020, so the world's like, all right, we're not all going to die tomorrow. We should maybe think about asset allocation or alternative assets or whatever that may be.
Because the stock market at that time is not doing well at all.
It was not pretty.
Yeah.
So we put this farm up, and the entire thing sold that afternoon. So over $1 million. That was the moment. The moment of the business was, oh my gosh, this is incredible. And people were emailing us, thanking us. You know, thank you so much for providing this opportunity to be involved and to support this. In this case, it was this organic apple grower in Washington. Jim, who we love. And so it's just this wildly positive moment. And I'm like, oh no, I need to go. And we're drinking and celebrating over Zoom. Like, oh right, I have to go hang out in the tent with the girls. And so I'm out in the tent, like drinking bourbon, writing this email to our user base, saying thank you for making this record day. And
I've often found, by the way, the email first, bourbon second is better than the other way around.
That's a decent rule of thumb.
I've unfortunately done it the other way once or twice, and that wasn't good. That's one of Joe's early lessons, so I'll share that with you. Let's talk about COVID for a second, because I know that COVID for Acre Trader was really that was kind of a pivotal time and a big change for the company.
It was. There's pros and cons to market volatility. Certainly the reevaluation of what's in one's portfolio comes along with volatility. We're seeing that right now in our business where we're not sure we're a counter-cyclical company, but anytime there's real movements, people look around and think, man, maybe I should consider other asset classes. So COVID for us was a positive we think was a net positive, but the bigger, far more impactful thing was actually like our team. And I just get to work with brilliant people every day. And we all went home and were like, all right, we're bored. What can we work on and really get out there and help push? And so we began putting out tons more content and educational webinars. And
this is where, by the way, you had to rely on technology, because now you go from an office where you're all together, Carter, to you can't meet.
That's right. We really doubled down. We absolutely worked our butts off and said, we're going to turn this terrible, terrible moment in time into an opportunity for our company. And I think the spirit of the folks I work with is what ultimately pushed that through and turned it into a big success for us.
That couldn't have been your initial reaction. I mean, I'm sure at first you thought what everybody else thought, this is going to kill our company.
We did. I was talking about this investment round a moment ago, our seed capital round. We raised a little over $3 million. That was closing on a Friday, supposed to close Friday morning. About Thursday is when the world's collapsing. This is March of 2020.
Oh, no.
The world's collapsing, completely falling apart. Friday, we're like, oh, my God, we all got to pack our bags and go home to work from home from here on out. And then the wire didn't come. And then there was this legal issue. And Elise, our general counsel, who is here, almost killed me for my neuroses that one day.
I can't imagine the amount of pacing you're doing.
Absolute, utter panic of this isn't going to happen. And if the wire doesn't cross today, it may never cross. And the bank, local bank, some friends here, a Signature Bank, kept the lanes open for us. And we were able to get the wire crossed past wire hours. Thank God. But yeah, that was a wild moment.
Wow. Let's talk about the future, AcreTrader. I know I was just looking online and I saw not farmland, but I saw a reference to woods, to forestry.
That's right. We like land. So we started with row crops in the Midwest and the Delta here. We then expanded out to permanent crops. So those are things you grow on trees, usually your vines, almonds, pistachios, blueberries, wine occasionally, wine grapes. Then after that, we expanded into Australia late last year. So as our first several international investments, we've invested, I think, a little over $30 million in Australian farms now, and timber's next. And we're not through. We're going to continue to expand product offerings and allow folks to gain more access to differentiated and unique investment products.
All still natural resources, land, natural resources, period.
That's the thing that we love.
Yeah. What excites you about the future?
Probably break that into two parts. The most exciting thing about work every day is the people I work with. I just get to work with absolutely amazing, amazing people. And we're very fortunate that we have a great product and we have a huge market. And so the thing that's going to define our success is the people I get to work next to every day. And by far and away, as I think out for the coming years, that's the most exciting thing, is that I am positive with this group of folks, we can solve any problem and we can build this business to be something truly changing, life-changing for the people we work with.
I want to end with a story about a farmer, because you know I was reading in Esquire magazine an interview with John Mellencamp, talking about how so many people don't understand the plight of the American farmer and really where they're at. And what you do has a big role in helping some of these farmers. Can you tell us a story of maybe one farmer you've been able to help because of the work that you do with AcreTrader?
Thank you for asking that. That was funny enough. The other part of my answer, what I'm excited about, is helping farmers and helping grow businesses in rural America. The story that would come to mind in this moment is, and we work with farmers again in, I think, 15 states and one other country. This would be Matt in Minnesota. Matt is an organic grower there, actually. So we do some organic investments. And Matt wants to grow his business. But Matt doesn't have $3 million to buy the parcel next door to go grow his business, much less than some of the capital necessary to make it through the transition years. You can't just flip a switch. You've got to transition for 3 years from conventional to organic. And so we've met Matt. He's a really, really brilliant farmer, and we were able to work with him. And he identified a parcel and said, hey, I would like to buy this and work with you guys to lease it. So we did that with him, and then we did that with him again. And the second time, he was actually able to also invest in that alongside us. And we have stories like that all over the country, and we're really, really proud that we get to work with amazing American farmers. These people work their butts off and run businesses, and that's the thing that really we all get to go to bed happy about every night.
Carter Malloy, everybody.
Thank you, Joe.
That's going to do it here from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Thank you so much to all of you in the audience. Thank you. Thanks to the Anchor Trader team for helping us put this together. Doug, my friend, you got it from here, man. What should we have learned today?
So what should we have learned today? First, thinking about building a company, build a foundation, and work through adversity. While you can't predict what's going to happen next, you can plan ahead and give yourself options when the inevitable lean times happen. Second, when you build your company, technology will pave a much easier pathway to success. Think, is there an automation that can make this happen more easily? But the big lesson, don't yell Woo-Pig Suey in a crowded library in Fayetteville. While watching librarians raise their arms slowly in unison is a blast, that you're in trouble look is way too similar to Joe's mom's you're washing windows, Doug. Again, way too close. Big thanks to Carter Malloy for joining us. You'll find more on AcreTrader at acretrader.com. Also, big thanks to our studio audience. You're a great-looking group of people here in Northwest Arkansas. And thanks to whoever built me this little booth under the table so you can only hear my voice. Hey, Joe, can I come out now? This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC, copyright 2022, and is created by Joe Salcihi. Our producer is Karen Repine. The show is written by the brilliant Paulette Perhatch with help from Joe, me, and Doc G from the Earn and Invest podcast. After you listen to our show, check out the 201 Deep Dives written by our website manager and blog editor, Brooke Miller. You'll find the 411 on all things money at the 201. Just go to stackingbenjamins.com/201. Once we bottle up all this goodness, we ship it to our engineer, the amazing Steve Stewart. Steve helps the rest of our team sound nearly as good as I do right now. Want to chat with friends about the show later? Mom's friend Gertrude is our social media coordinator and the room mother in our Facebook group called The Basement. So, say hello when you see us posting online. Here's a weird fact. Both she and Tina Eichenberg are never in the same room at the same time. To join all the basement fun with other stackers, type stackingbenjamins.com/basement. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we'll see you next time back here at the Stacking Benjamin Show. Not only should you not take advice from these dorks, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any financial decisions, speak with a real financial advisor.
I can't believe we did that live. Welcome to the after show.
What were we doing? Just that was really weird.
This is the part of the show that doesn't exist. If you have to talk about the, well, the first rule of after show is we don't talk about the after show, Fayetteville. All right. If you have to, we've had people, Carter, from time to time that have had to tell friends about it. You can say dessert, right? This is the part of the show where we no longer talk about AcreTrader. Maybe we do talk about AcreTrader, but we talk about random stuff that Carter and I want to talk about for, I don't know, 4 or 5 more hours.
For the after show.
Yeah, you told me to come up with something funny about farmers earlier. And Garrett, our COO, my partner in crime, who's, I think is up here somewhere. Not all farmers would find my personality to be endearing, I guess. You know, like a fast-talking technology guy. Garrett is much more attuned to that world. He's 35 and looks much older. He dresses like my 88-year-old dad.
35 going on 88.
Yeah, he carries a handkerchief and a pocket knife everywhere he goes. You know, it's like a real man of the land. And so
it sounds like you guys do a game of good cop, bad cop sometimes then, or young cop, old cop.
Yeah. Well, in this case, I'm like, Garrett, I got to go. I know farmers, dude. Come with me. We're going to go meet this farmer that I know who is a large and successful farmer. So we go to this steak restaurant. The guy's like, we're going to go to the steakhouse for lunch. We're like, cool. I guess we'll go get a salad or something. So we sit down. He shows up, takes a call immediately at this table of three of us, and then doesn't stay on the phone for like 30 seconds, stays on the phone for most of this entire time.
You're kidding me.
So let's call it like 9 minutes, like a long, long, long time. So Garrett and I are like, well, I guess we'll get ready and order the salad. You know, and this person comes around, waitress comes around, and he's, hey, we're going to have the porterhouse medium rare. All right, looks like we're having a porterhouse, Garrett. This guy ordered for us. And then gets back on the phone. So they finally bring the porterhouse around, and this is this huge steak, right?
Yeah, monster steak.
And it's two pieces. It's a New York strip on one side and a filet, the really good stuff on the other side of the bone. And so they, at this restaurant, they cut the steak up into small slices, smaller slices. So this guy grabs the tongs and serves himself the entire filet, the coveted meat, you know, the piece you really want, and then serves us the junk, the dog food, on a relative basis, right? The tough stuff. And we, like, it's just this moment of, oh my God, we are just absolutely getting dominated. And he did pay, and we left, and it's like, I'm sorry. I was telling Garrett, I was like, I'm not sure what just happened, but we definitely lost. Like that guy won.
Yes. Somebody claiming their territory right from the beginning. Yeah. I was surprised you didn't come over to, now that you learned your lesson, and grab this mic and just take over the podcast. Well, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode. But one thing that we talked about a little bit today, but we talk about a lot, is you got to have good partners on your team, Stackers. And you know what? Navy Federal Credit Union could be that partner, because becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. And aren't those two of the big tenets, right? Have a debt strategy, earn more, save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. I think that's the coolest certificate. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project? Maybe you want to consolidate debt. Well, as you're putting your plan together, you want to also have a debt strategy, right? And you could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed rate home equity loan with zero closing cost, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Don't get in over your head with debt. Make sure you have a great strategy, and then take out debt as you need it. And Navy Federal's options certainly give you the flexibility to help you make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, equal housing lender, membership required, terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval.